But this is outrageous, you hear a silk-clad merchant cry out. I'm sorry, sir, but no arms are to be carried further down this river. Their journey will end here. You see the man in chainmail carry away an assortment of swords, axes, and polearms, no doubt from the workshops along the Rhine. This conflict tells you that you are now close to your goal, here, at the edge of the great imperial Francia. It seems you are finally closer than ever to aiding the great brothers of Constantine and Methodius. Their missionary efforts among the Slavs had gathered quite the reputation back home, and stories of their achievements had led to your choice to become their disciple. After honorary visits to the sees of Passau and Salzburg, you are now finally leaving the comfort of the established Christian world and heading into the very frontiers of the holy and universal faith. As the merchant vessel you are riding with sails further down the river, you begin to see signs of this frontier in action. Sparse fortifications begin to be replaced with a consistent dotting of mighty earthen ramparts and palisades at high points along the river. Before long, you come across the remains of the first burnt-out village. You think that if you look close enough, you can almost still see the whispers of smoke rising from the charred ruins. Before long, the ships arrive at a tributary, and the Roman take to their stations to row hard up it. You know from your studies that this must be the Morava, which almost certainly means you have entered the territory of the mysterious power which inhabits this land, the Moravians. Among the trees, you can make out the periodic movements of men on horseback, slowly tracking the movements of the vessel. Eventually, they come out to follow the boat up the river, guiding it in to rest within sight of a mighty fortification, dominating the sight over the floodplains of the Morava around it. The merchants begin to prepare for overland crossings, likely exchanging some goods here and perhaps more out beyond, to Olomouc, Krakow, or even further. For you, though, this is the end of the line. It's time to find those brothers and see just how exactly they plan to pacify the war zone around them. Back to Between the Seas. This is episode 2 in our series documenting the rise and fall of inter-European states during this time of change that was the 9th and early 10th centuries. Today, we'll look at what is widely credited as the first properly organized Western Slavic polity, that being what will become known as Great Moravia. Our story begins with the downfall of the Avar Confederacy, whose leading group of horsemen would finally be totally defeated by the forces of Charlemagne and his son in Italy. As mentioned before in our video on the Slavs of Lower Pannonia, several tribes which had been under Avar domination would take Frankish offers to join in on the destruction of their overlord. Late Avar developments had leaned into a divestment of power, as the steppe traditions which had once kept their leading group close and unbreakable began to break down due to the climatic change and slow integration with the settled societies around them. With this, they would be forced to rely on the more autonomous peripheries, though they would still deny them full independence or the ability to break into their ranks. This would combine with tales of widespread abuse of the population to lead to many of these peripheral Slavic tribes to join the Frankish campaigns. Avar and wider steppe tactics had, over hundreds of years of influence, spread to deeply impact these tribal Slavic societies, and many within them would come to mirror the Avar tactics. As in Francia, the leading men would fight on horseback, allowing for quick movement and devastating raids. With major Frankish attention and widespread Slavic revolts, the Avars would be defeated, and reduced to marcher status on a small part of the Danubian frontier of the new Frankish Empire. The tribes which had revolted against the Avars would now find themselves under Frankish influence, simply a part of the deal that came with the destruction of the only other major power in the region. However, as we have previously learned about these inner European frontier regions, control does not work as lines on a map or as perpetual contracts between nations. Control was personal and operated on the axes of personal influence and granted privileges of access to certain trade routes or local resources. Just as easily as influence is gained through prestige or a show of force, it is lost by time, or even something as simple as the force of personality of individual tribes. The French simply did not have the resources or the care to devote large forces to consistently enforcing the client status of these tribes on the outer periphery of their empire. This became doubly true with the death of Charlemagne and the gradual weakening of the united empire. To further add to this, the Bulgars would launch campaigns to absorb the eastern half of the Avar Confederacy, eventually meeting the Frankish marches somewhere near the middle Danube or Tisza. This action would make the Bulgars a great power, and as the borderlands now of not one but two great powers once more, the tribes could easily play them off of each other and gain further freedom from their influence in the process. What this left, then, was a wide swath of populations, ranging from the Bohemian Basin through Pannonia and the Dinaric Alps, all the way to Transylvania and the Iron Gates of the Danube, which remained largely left to their own devices, occasionally leaning one way or the other, but with only sporadic interventions by the great powers that be. And it is in this environment that we turn now to Moravia and Nitra. Moravia and Nitra roughly made up the lands between the Upper Danube in modern Austria and Hungary, and the Carpathians in modern Slovakia and Czechia. These lands were temperate, though also very hilly and forested. The Morava River pushes north into the region, and carves out an inhabitable local base of power, surrounded by the rougher terrain. It also leads to the main gate between the plateau and the riverlands, that being the Moravian Gate. Here, the Carpathians lower to turn into the Sudetes, and the Oder River finds its source to flow north to the Baltic Sea. The mighty Amber Road uses this opportunity to cross the mountain ranges, successfully linking northern Inner Europe and the trade nodes of the Baltic to southern Inner Europe and eventually the trade nodes of the Mediterranean. As we have said before about Carpathia, it is a land of many small pockets of self-sufficient land, surrounded on almost all sides by terrain which promotes defense and autonomy. All these pockets are only connected by their common reliance on the Danube. Another one of these pockets is Nitra, which together with Moravia will make the core of the entity that we are talking about today. The Principality of Nitra covered what is essentially Western Slovakia today. It is another fertile land surrounded by defensible terrain, with the exception of that which faces the Danube to the south. Because of this pocket, it offers a chance for its local power base to control access within the Danube itself, particularly at the site of modern Bratislava and the namesake fortifications at Nitra. This control allows the region to punch above its size politically, and it will form a large part of Moravian power, despite the Moravian core being just over the Little Carpathians in the Morava River basin. Within this setting, we can finally introduce the Moravians, a Slavic tribe of people which named themselves after the Morava River, which itself derives simply from the old term for water, sea, or marsh, mare. The Moravians likely participated with the Franks in the overthrow of the Avar Confederacy in the early 9th century. As such, they also experienced the decades of anarchy which followed. The lack of a dominating force ushered in intertribal conflict. This was because each tribe was essentially a family-like unit made up of individual clans, which held together its legitimacy as a unit through raiding and control of interregional trade, both of which would promote conflict. In this way, the shattered region of Carpathia in this time is quite comparable to the Riverlands. And here, too, the gorge system that we discussed last time will come to prominence. Individual tribes who proved to be more successful in centralizing their force to a ruling dynasty and were able to both bring back goods from raiding and somewhat toll-passing trade gained the centralizing ability which was needed to stratify and organize their tribe. The leading dynasty would solidify their power through these external actions and grant the leading warriors of the society leading roles and lands. And these warriors could then successfully mobilize the families that they held influence with to either join their tribal levies or participate in fortification projects. The dependence on tribal levies and trade choke points encouraged tribal identification with the land itself and promoted fortification rather than migration when faced with threats. To add into this mix, which was simultaneously developing in the Riverlands, though, was the very real and direct Frankish influence in Carpathia. The Franks, at this time, as we remember, were developing a sort of early feudalism based on a hereditary aristocracy that first gained prominence similarly through loyal military service, but solidified influence through their identification with the many self-sufficient villages which had sprang up throughout the Frankish realms over the past centuries. When the aristocracy could no longer be rewarded with loot and lands, they were then rewarded with privileges, including hereditary rule and organized fiefs. In return, they would utilize the resources of their village to provide for semi-professional armored horsemen and participate in leading and advising the king. These similar systems differed mostly in their specialization. Privileges in the Germanic world were specific and outlined according to specific social relationships, whereas in the Gord system, most authority was still unspecialized, thus resembling chiefdoms more than a military aristocracy. They also lacked the unifying force of the Church and of Rome, which had worked to unite the East Franks into a sort of consensus-based unity. Through Frankish military interventions and periodic enforcements of client status among the Slavs, they would work to alter and accelerate the development of the Gord system. Static fortifications would soon be promoted throughout Carpathia, just as they had been promoted on the borderlands of the Frankish Empire. Ties to locality were strengthened. The dominance of cavalry and the prevalence of more advanced mail armor and finely crafted weapons would begin to both flow in and be created throughout the tribal lands. Eventually, military forces and fortifications would begin to look quite similar between the Franks and the Slavic tribes who had once been seen as almost natural tributaries. Above all, Christianity would begin to be introduced to the tribes, and with it, the desire for greater cooperation, natural order, and improvement. The Moravians would pioneer this new Gord system relatively early on. The first known leader of the Moravians would be a man known as Moimir, who headed the tribe sometime in the 820s or 830s. In the 830s, he would unify the two main regions of the future organization through his conquest of Nitra, which had been a competing Slavic force in the region. Nitra was actually the first Slavic tribe known to have accepted Christianity and requested the construction of a church in their land under the leader Probina, who we have met before. Corbina would be ejected and seek refuge in Frankish lands, where he would eventually be put back in control over March lands in Pannonia, as a counterforce to the growing Moravians. The Moravians, with the acquisition of Nitra, would now hold a very prominent position in the region, and with their organized force of horsemen, effectively told the trade which passed along the Danube and through the Moravian gates in either direction. Trade would then allow the ruling clan, headed by Moimir, to further consolidate their own power, grow their retinue, and fortify their strategic villages to protect access to and from the land. Because of the small, family-like nature of tribes, the greatest challenge to growth of a strong group will be the search for an identity that could unite these tribes into a greater parent tribal identity. This identity would be found first from the leading position as Slavic adopters of Christianity, and second from the great powers around them. The consistent threat, but also great wealth of the Franks, would allow the Moravians to unite several Slavic tribal units together in what has been coined by Lumir Palatsik of the Brno Institute of Archaeology as an imperial confederacy. Here, the powerful leading force of the Moimirid dynasty of Moravia, propped up by its control of rising trade forces in inner Europe, would utilize its growing warrior class to align several small and almost completely autonomous tribal units towards the same goal. This goal would be to exploit the great powers of the Franks and to a lesser extent the Bulgars, through coordinated raiding and coordinated regulation and taxation of trade coming from their directions. The prestige goods, such as precious metals or fine manufactured goods, would then be redistributed and shared to allow continued alignment of these mostly independent chiefdoms. In this way, the Moravians would align groups all along the Danube, with evidence of tribes as far afield as modern Serbia joining the cause to raid and trade with the Franks. In fact, this region even contains a second possible Moravia, centered around the mighty Morava River of Serbia. There is written evidence for a relatively strong power having emerged there after the fall of the Avars, likely fortifying routes along the many river connections surrounding the Drava, Sava, Morava, and Danube rivers, around the ancient base of Sirmium. Although archaeological evidence points towards the core of Moravian civilization being near modern Slovakia and Czechia as described, it just goes to show the rising prevalence of fortification and the cornering of trade among the inner European Slavs. For our story, this tribe would perhaps work in tandem with the Moravians, in a lucid union with other tribes, allowing for mutual cooperation to over time strengthen the Moravian identity as a parent tribe of the entire region in general. However, the rise of another strong power on the Pannonian Basin, one based off of opposing Frankish power no less, would not be in the plans for the leaders of East Francia. In 845, Louis the German would send a force to intervene in Moravia, and successfully steer the next prince of Moravia to be a Frankish vassal, Moimir's nephew Rostislav. Rostislav would work to further consolidate influence over the loose union of Moravian-aligned tribes, and despite his placement there by the Franks, would break free from the Franks following skirmishes in 855. The Moravians would always follow a leading character of caution combined with action, where despite the dangerous fate of choosing a more independent path, this path would be taken, though with deliberate steps to further cohesion and gain recognition from the powers around them. Following the push for autonomy, Rostislav would turn to the church once more to help solidify an identity. He would send a letter to the Pope in Rome, asking for further missionary resources to Christianize his lands. The church had previously recognized Moravia as a separate polity to the Franks during Moimir's time, and Rostislav successfully hoped that further integration with the church system would be the key to becoming a part of the omnipresent and growing continental administration of Europe. Through joining this church hierarchy, Moravia could then be locked in as a unique locality, come what may to their political independence. Rostislav would be let down, however, by the squabbling of the church factions at this point in history. Within Carpathia, the Byzantine faction had been diminished due to their lack of control over the Balkans. The Latin faction had retained roots along Dalmatia and formerly Latin communities of the area, while the German Bishop of Passau and Archbishop of Salzburg had pushed with the Frankish conquest to gain jurisdiction over much of the continental Danubian portion. As always, though, the Latins would be distrustful of independent German action in the area, and so despite efforts from Passau and Salzburg to evangelize, they would receive little support from the Latins. For their part, the Latins were more concerned at this point with combating the domineering forces of local Italian dukes and marches, who had risen to prominence since the collapse of the unity of the Frankish Empire in the 840s. As a result of this politicking, Rostislav's letter to the Pope would go completely ignored. This left Moravia's ecclesiastic future in the hands of the Germans, which was not a desirable position as far as longer-term autonomy from the Franks was concerned. So, instead, Rostislav would send a letter to the Emperor of Constantinople. The Byzantines, in opposition to the Franks and the Pope, were actually on the rise this time, and looking to regain influence in Europe. The prime way that they could do this was with the soft power of their intricate and ancient culture, their wealth of Mediterranean trade, and their control over the main resources of the universal Christian Church. The Byzantine emperor would send two clerical brothers, known as Constantine and Methodius, to answer the requests of the Moravians. These brothers had been born and raised in Thessalonica, and so had learned that variant of the Slavic language and their interactions in local evangelization efforts. So, with their mission given, they would begin to build ways to more effectively spread the word in Slavic lands. This would lead them to develop Glagolitic script, which was an early alphabet for Slavic languages. With this new script, they would translate almost the entirety of the Bible into a language known as Early Church Slavonic, and teach several disciples to utilize this language in their teachings. They would then travel to Moravian lands and find immense success in the spread of these resources. Much of Moravia, especially among the elites, had already been converted to Christianity, but had not had much integration or exposure to church and liturgical practices. The Glagolitic script in Church Slavonic changed this completely and allowed for a homegrown Slavic church culture to develop. Numerous more churches would be founded and disciples trained and sent to Great Moravia. Here they would translate and develop numerous writings for the Moravians, ultimately assisting their consolidation of the local tribes around them with the provision of a legitimate hierarchical structure. Sermons and church services would be provided in this Church Slavonic, ultimately greatly helping to align the faith of the elites with those of the freemen who made up their levies. Ultimately, however, these church efforts would greatly interfere both with Frankish hegemony, and especially with the jurisdictions of Passau and Salzburg, which still held influence over a growing web of missionary work and church construction within Pannonia, including, formally, Moravia itself. The German church gained most of its power through its uniformity, a cohesive force in opposition to the many independent communities and the competing stem duchies. A Slavic liturgy challenged this uniformity in its most vulnerable area, the eastern borderlands. Consistent church conflict would eventually lead Constantine and Methodius to journey to Rome at the invitation of the Pope, who had finally become involved in the ongoing disputes. Surprisingly, the Pope would side with the two brothers, and welcome Old Church Slavonic as one of the now four approved languages for liturgy. It's hard to understate the importance of this decision for Inner Europe, as it expanded the language of the Church from the original three languages of the Holy Writings themselves, those being Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, to include Church Slavonic as the fourth, standing as an equal. In addition to this decision, Methodius would be made into Archbishop of Sirmium, and given jurisdiction over much of Pannonia and all of Moravia, in direct opposition to the two German seats. Meanwhile, Constantine would become a monk and soon pass away, with his name becoming better known by his later monastic title, Cyril. Methodius, now alone, would be free to journey back and continue his mission with his remaining disciples, several of which would become saints for their missionary efforts among the many groups of Slavs. Although the German church officials would not back down from their protestations, even abducting Methodius at one point, the Slavic evangelization efforts would be largely successful. This continued until the death of Methodius, at which point forces would move against his new Slavic liturgy in the country. The Bishop of Nitra, more aligned with the German faction, and perhaps hoping to avoid excessive political consolidation over the church, would push for Latin to be reinstated as the only official language of the liturgy within Moravian lands, and he would ultimately succeed in this effort. The Pope would likewise remove Old Church Slavonic as one of the four accepted languages, and Methodius's disciples would be expelled from Moravia. Despite this, they would continue their work, mostly collecting themselves within the Bulgar Empire, which was undergoing a Christianization effort of its own. Here, they would refine the language to develop the Cyrillic alphabet, named after their mentor, Saint Cyril, and be deeply influential in the development of the Bulgarian Church, as we will cover more next episode. Despite its short period in Moravia and Pannonia, this evangelization effort would be a domino that would ultimately lead to the Christianization of almost the entire Slavic elite of Inner Europe in only about 100 years. Besides the deeply fundamental changes to worldview and culture, this would also help to spread the Frankish-influenced gord system across the Riverlands, working to further stratify the land into local units and self-identified cultures with defined traditions. There's no getting around, however, that the loss of Church Slavonic was a loss to the Moravian project of building a coherent identity. Let's get back to this story of the Moravian Union, though. Rostislav, in the 860s, would gain the ire of the East Franks once again, and eventually Louis the German would strike directly into Moravian territory. As was the nature of these conflicts, though, the state as a whole would not be subsumed into East Francia, and most strongholds protecting the bases of power would hold out. Rostislav himself had been trapped in a castle near the frontier, which Louis's army had surrounded and put to a siege. Rostislav would end up parleying from this dire situation, eventually accepting Frankish subjugation and overlordship once more. Despite this, a reality of subjugation was not what took place, and the Moravian sphere of tribes would continue to raid and resist Frankish pushes within Pannonia. This would continue until 869, when internal Moravian affairs would suddenly interfere. Rostislav's nephew, a man named Svatopluk, led a very strong internal faction within the Union, likely holding influence throughout that great second region of the Moravian core, Nitra. Through Frankish accounts, we learn that he would attempt to negotiate with the Franks separately from Rostislav. Although control over most internal affairs was acceptable in this pattern of rule, controlling such things as sovereignty and matters of war with an existential enemy were not. Rostislav would seek to have his nephew strangled for his disobedience. Svatopluk would remain one step ahead of his uncle, though, and aware of his plans, would have his men imprison Rostislav instead. Svatopluk would seek to make peace with the Franks by turning over Rostislav to them. The great king would die in captivity, after being found guilty of treason. Svatopluk himself would not find a much kinder fate from the Franks, though, with Moravian lands being placed under direct Frankish control by Carloman, who was a son of Louis the German. Soon, Svatopluk himself would be imprisoned on charges of disloyalty, and sent away into the East Frankian interior. This, however, would be where we see the results of the Moravian project of identity building. Rather than being subsumed into the East Frankish realm, local notables and aristocrats would instead elect a man known as Slavomir to lead them in revolt against the Germans. Slavomir was another member of the Moimirid dynasty, showing a measure of loyalty to the civilizing mission which was being led by that clan from the choke points on the Morava. Bitter years of war would follow this elevation. I believe now would be a good time to describe the nature of warfare in this time and place. In short, it was a terrifying and brutal experience. The fortification of the countryside had led to the emergence of many small bands of local power, bands who always had a place to retreat to when severely threatened. True conquest or advancement would require securing supply lines and territory from these scattered bands on either side of the frontier, an action which could only be accomplished through taking these hilltop and river bend fortifications. Most of these had grown to be quite complex, with Slavs and Bavarians becoming quite skilled at the manipulation of earth to create ditches, rough hills, and mounds surrounding the dense marsh or variable floodplains. The foundations could then be lined with wooden stakes to create thick walled containers, filled with yet more earth and assortments of rock. Retinues of the period could very rarely afford to take the time for a prolonged siege, and so usually they didn't bother. Battles were also generally avoided, though, due to the high risk that an even engagement carried with it. What this left, then, were the poor settlements scattered between the strong points. Wars would be fought with the objective of demoralization and the creation of widespread desolation. On both sides, loot would remain a primary motivator for the individual levy. This would lead to the consistent razing of villages across the frontier, and the slaughtering, ejection, or scattering of the local populace. This, in turn, would only deepen resentment and further destabilize the region, leading to yet more extreme acts of violence and chaos. Despite this, the populations endured, and times of constant skirmishing and war would produce very able and experienced military leaders, who with enough success could consolidate leading positions among the villages, and integrate themselves within the wider Moravian network of trade redistribution and spoils of war. These resources could then be used to strengthen the local defenses, and attempt to prevent future incursions, thus ultimately working to right itself. The Moravians had built a strong enough network of these local powers that the Franks would be repulsed from their attempted annexation. They would be forced to send a different army of conquest led by Svatopluk himself, with the mission to unseat Slavomir. Svatopluk, though, having been freed, would seemingly have learned to not trust his Frankish benefactors, and soon he would defect from the main Frankish army, ultimately joining the Moravians and helping to lead them to a decisive victory over the Germans. With this, Slavomir, who had desired more so to become a priest than to become a king, would step down in favor of Svatopluk, and under Svatopluk, Moravia would be able to flex its newly found might. With a strong Christian base, effective legitimacy of his dynasty, and skilled veteran tribal dependents, Moravia would begin to formalize their relationship with neighboring Slavic tribes. Wars of subjugation would be launched outward, specifically focusing on strong points of long-distance trade in the area. Fraud would be one such target, with the tribe of the Czechs being subjugated and then given dominion over neighboring tribes in the Bohemian Basin. Campaigns would also be launched along the Danube and into Pannonia itself, competing for influence over the local tribes, with both the Franks and the Bulgars, and further consolidating control over the vital river. Both of these campaigns would work to solidify Moravian ties which had already been developing in the region, and bring more autonomous tribes closer to the central orbit. Seemingly, the main direction of Svatopluk's expansion, though, would be through the Moravian Gates and into the Riverlands. The Oder and Vistula River both found their source near the Moravian Gate, and effectively guided the Baltic markets inland along them. Olomouc, a Moravian city nearby the gate, had likely been the main international node of the Moravians for this reason, but growing cities were beginning to spring within the rapidly changing riverlands. Kraków and Przemyśl are the two main examples of such towns in the riverlands, and Svatopluk would work to expand Moravian presence north of the Carpathians to gain influence over this passing commerce. We are told that he launched campaigns into Lesser Poland and Silesia, Christianizing the local rulers there and bringing them into the Moravian-led network of tribes. Within Kraków, there is evidence of significant Moravian influence, most notably through a sort of proto-currency which consisted of axe-shaped iron bars. See, within these rural frontier societies, production tended to be very decentralized. Different localities would have various markets, which normally made up a geographical ring that represented a day or two's march. Within these local markets, bartering would predominate. Due to the extreme differences between localities, however, bartering would not allow for efficient intra-regional exchange. Precious metal currency would be the best way to substitute value for this purpose, due to their scarcity and extreme durability, leading to high value for weight, but could not be effectively used in frontier confederations such as Moravia. This is mostly because of its extreme rarity. Few precious metal mines were being exploited in the region at this time, and so all supply that did come came from abroad. This limited resource would be invaluable to the central Moravian elite, which regulated the long-distance trade through Moravian strongpoints. And so it served strictly as a prestige good used to honor allies and maintain the tribal dependencies. For the actual running of local market exchange, then, a different currency was needed. And this would come about organically through local consensus, in a process known as commodity money. Commodity money consisted of culturally unique mediums for exchange, which were often agricultural in nature. Within Great Moravia, though, iron from the hills would become a plentiful rural commodity, and soon a specifically shaped iron artifact would serve as the drivers of these local economies. Because of its cultural uniqueness, we can tell Moravian impact on a land through the presence of these iron axe tokens. Kraków had a particularly large supply, which suggests that they were an important tributary outpost for the Moravians. For our narrative, we can consider them a loosely aligned, yet distinctly important center of Moravian influence, which would begin to radiate the influence of Church Slavonic and the Dord system across the wider riverlands. Svatopluk would successfully expand the Moravian sphere of influence while the eastern Franks of the frontier recovered from their failed annexation. This expansion, however, would likely have exhausted many of the leading clans' resources and pushed ties with leading chieftains to their limits for further concessions and less exclusivity in their redistribution network. There had been 20 years of relative peace with the Franks, and 20 years of rapid expansion of Moravian influence. By 893, though, all attempts for full Moravian independence within the church system had failed, and the Franks found the opportunity to invade once more. This came at a poor time for the Moravians, as the main product of all their conquests, prestige, and legitimacy towards the ruling dynasty would take a severe blow with the death of Svatopluk in 894. His son, Moimir II, would take over, but find the Moravian network to be bursting at its seams, with disloyal tributaries, aloof tribal dependencies, and internal squabbles among his closest family members. The tribes beyond the Moravian gates had not completed the painful process of establishing control and integration with the church, and so would revolt almost immediately upon Svatopluk's death, successfully restoring pagan rule and breaking away from the wider Moravian network. At the same time, Moimir's brother, Svatopluk II, would also revolt, thus fracturing the cautiously crafted core network of the Imperial Confederacy, and critically weakening their defenses. Arnulf of Carinthia, possessing not only the full might of East Francia, but also the local might of his base of power in Carinthia, would launch a serious invasion. Together with his Slavic ally in Balaton, most Moravian gains in Pannonia would be reversed, and their military resources exhausted. He would also ally with the nomadic tribe which had been steadily growing in prominence on the other side of the Carpathians, the Magyar, and encourage them to push against the Moravians from the east flank. Arnulf would die in 899, having been unsuccessful once again in conquering the intensely fortified Moravian heartland. His Magyar allies, though, would at this point sense an opportunity, and, having been pushed from Moldavia by invading Pechenegs, fully commit to a conquest of Pannonia. The Magyar would continue their devastating push, and with their full tribe migrating, commit to the intimidating sieges that the squabbling Frankish armies had neglected. With the tide rapidly changing, the Moravians would ally with their former enemies in Bavaria to stop the invading nomads, but it was too late. All would be vanquished by the Magyars. Moimir II would allegedly fall in battle against them in Pannonia in 906, with his Bavarian and Pannonian allies being annihilated 1 year later, either outside the Moravian stronghold of Pressburg or the Slavic stronghold of Blatnograd. With the Moimirid and core Moravian control now fully undermined politically, the union of tribes which had bought into the Imperial Confederacy and given it its power now collapsed, ceasing to have any effect. The Czechs, once trusted allies and key tributaries of the Moravians, would be able to hold on to power within the Bohemian Basin itself, and come to form the most powerful successor. But with that, the story of Great Moravia came to an end. A true story of trial and error in the brutally developing world of inner Europe. The ultimate defeat of Moravia does not have to be a story of failure, though, and I think this interpretation would be quite incorrect. Besides lasting for almost a century, the later application of the word great, I think, can be used as a good metaphor for their legacy. The term great, in relation to this Moravian union of tribes, comes from De Administrando Imperii, previously mentioned as a Byzantine guide on the surrounding states in the 10th century, which was written after the fall of Moravia. In this sense, great did not necessarily mean imperial and mighty, as it may imply, but more so old or respected. Similar terminology was used for White Croatia, signaling it as the respected ancestor of the Croatians the Byzantines dealt with more directly on the Adriatic. In this sense, I think we can see Great Moravia as the first real experiment with the homegrown, inner European, Christian identity, especially among the Slavs. From the intentional control and dispersal of trade choke points, to effective defense against repeated Frankish incursions, to their promotion of dedicated church efforts within Carpathia and the Riverlands, they will leave many loose ends that will be claimed by many more ambitious clans and aspiring unifiers. Still, though, they would ultimately fall, leaving their successors power only to ponder over their legacy. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Between the Seas. We'll continue this series next time with a final look further south in Carpathia at the developments and growing identity of Serbia, uniting into a union now only for the first time. We'll also take a closer look at a power which has featured in several other stories, the Bulgar Empire, as they continue the struggle for their identity, with some help from an abundance of expelled former Moravian disciples, who brought with them some very interesting tools. Tools which would help transform the Bulgars into the Bulgarians. Until then, this has been Jacob, and I hope that you can take the time today to appreciate your own alphabet.